Welcome to the Senate Committee. Are we good? I'll call the April 22nd meeting of the Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development to order. We have a pretty full agenda. We are going to be taking one bill up out of order, and I will start by opening a work session on Senate Bill 821. Jeremy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 821, we heard this previously on April 1st, and it permits collective bargaining unit and public employer to establish a retiree medical trust, a volunteer employees beneficiary association, a health reimbursement arrangement, or other health care agreement for health care expenses of employees or retirees. It declares an emergency and it's effective on passage. We have a statement of no revenue impact. We do not have a fiscal yet. We have two proposed amendments to the bill, -1 and -2, and we're looking to go ahead and adopt those today, and then we'll have the fiscal by the next work session.
And
we'll have to carry it over.
Did you want to explain these amendments, or should I call someone forward to do that? How about Brian DeLashmit? Did you want to come forward and talk about the -1 and -2 very briefly?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Brian DeLashmit. I'm here representing the Oregon State Police Officers Association, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. Neither the -1s or the -2s are amendments that we're introducing, but are being introduced by other parties. My understanding of the -1s from the part of the Insurance Commissioner's Office clarifies that these plans would have to conform to the insurance code. If they believe that that needs to be done for clarification, that's fine with me. I have not seen the -2s. I was aware those -2s being offered by the OEA. That clarify that this doesn't impact their interrelationship between the OEA and OEBB, Oregon Employment Education Benefit Board. I'm fine with those as well.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Prezantsky.
I'm going to make a motion. Do you want them to be adopted singly or together?
Why don't we do them one at a time?
All right, Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the -1s in Senate Bill 821.
Senator Prezantsky has moved the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 821. Is there discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, amendment is adopted. Senator Prezantsky.
Madam Chair, I move for the adoption of the -2s in the Senate Bill 821.
And Senator Prezantsky moves adoption of the -2 amendment to Senate Bill 821. Is there any discussion?
I have a question,
yes,
Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
So basically, just review again that this bill will actually then set up a fund, a trust for health insurance. Explain exactly what it does.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Mona Sanderson, it allows an employees group, for example, the Oregon State Troopers Association, in negotiations with the state, to have pre-tax dollars taken out of the individual troopers' pay that would go into a separate fund that would help pay for their post-retirement health care.
That's right. I just had to be reviewed.
Right. Yeah. Okay, and so we're on the -2 amendment. Is there any further discussion on the amendment? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Actually, I guess we can make a motion to move the bill. Oh, no, we can't do that because we don't have the fiscal yet.
So we need to carry it over to the next work session.
Okay, so let's carry Senate Bill 821 over to our next hearing in work session.
And Madam Chair, for the record, that's going to be Monday the 27th.
That's correct. Okay. And that would be the last day to...
That's why we want to make sure it's on the record.
That's very important. Okay, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 821. And I see Senator Starr is here with us, and we do have several bills, I think two of which he wants to testify on. So I'm going to go back up to the top of the agenda and open simultaneously a public hearing on Senate Bill 702 and a
707.
A public hearing on Senate Bill 707 and a public hearing on Senate Bill 708. And Jeremy, do you want to briefly explain those bills?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 707 provides that an employer who discloses information about a current or former employee's job performance to a prospective employer of the employee is presumed to be acting in good faith and is immune from civil liability unless the presumption is rebutted by clear and convincing evidence. We have a statement of no revenue impact, and we do not have a fiscal on it. Senate Bill 708 requires all current and former employers and former prospective employers of law enforcement agency applicants to provide all information available relating to the applicant upon request of the law enforcement agency. It limits the law enforcement agency's use and disclosure of the information received. It also allows employees to inspect information received by a law enforcement agency as part of the personnel records of the employee. And again, we have no revenue impact, and we do not have a fiscal on it.
Okay, thank you. And I want to point out, members, we do have a written document of testimony that's been provided to you on Senate Bill 707 for your file. And please, Senator Starr, welcome to our committee, and please go ahead.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Bruce Starr. I'm your state senator from District 15, Western Washington County. I'm pleased to be able to testify briefly this afternoon on Senate Bill 707 and 708. Madam Chair, members of the committee, these are bills that I introduced on behalf of the Washington County Sheriff's Office. The committee, the bills themselves say Dennis Griffith. That's been corrected. If and when these bills are amended and reprinted, it will accurately show that Washington County is the sheriff's office is who we've introduced these bills on the request of. These bills have to do with employee hiring, particularly as it relates to law enforcement. These are issues that we have a number of individuals here that can speak much more authoritatively than I can for certain, just because I honestly don't deal with these issues on a day-in and day-out basis, but I thought it was important to be here to lend my support, and thank you, Madam Chair, for scheduling the bill for a public hearing. I encourage you to listen to the testimony of the individuals that do work on these issues day in and day out, and learn as much as you can, as I have, about this issue. And my hope would be that you would not only hear the bill, but work the bill and move the bill forward. There is a -1 amendment to Senate Bill 708. I believe that further clarifies the purpose of the bill. With me here is Mr. Powell and Mr. Campbell, representing the sheriffs and the chiefs of police, that both organizations are supportive. And at this point, I'd be happy to turn the microphone over to Mr. Powell.
Great. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Madam Chair, while this bill was introduced at the request of Washington County Sheriff's Office,
did you tell us who you were?
No, I was just going to.
I
represent Oregon's 36 county sheriffs. And while it's at the request of Washington County, all of the sheriffs share the belief that these bills are important pieces of legislation. This has been a consternation for some years and growing amongst law enforcement agencies and employing people. I think perhaps Senator Brzozinski has seen bills introduced to allow lie detectors to be used for employment purposes. So there have been several avenues looked at, and nothing has come to fruition in terms of providing an answer. So hopefully just allowing people to pass on legitimate information and allow the employee to see it and refute it if necessary is a good first step, at least, in trying to get good employees at the beginning. Thank you.
Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. We also support Senate Bill 707 and 708. I'm also not an expert in this, and you'll be hearing from people that do have expertise specifically in these situations, but I will say on behalf of the association that I represent that this is a subject of concern that's expressed regularly in our annual conferences when we meet together. It's a concern because, as you know, the most important decision, frankly, any business makes is their first decision. That's the decision to hire. When they make good decisions to hire, it has long-term positive results on the agency and the organization. It is very true in law enforcement, where we're turning over to individuals the ability to enforce laws that can take away people's freedom, that involve their constitutional rights. And more, it is a concern among agencies that they are not able to get complete information about people when they're trying to make those hiring decisions. It is these bills both, I think, come out of a good faith effort and goodwill to help us provide as much good information as possible. It does require that agencies operate in good faith, which I think is very important, and I appreciate Senator Starr for introducing this bill and for the committee's willingness to hear it and consider moving it. So thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Okay, thank you all for your testimony. Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much. And next we will call Pat Garrett and Dennis Griffiths. Janet, not sure what Janet's last name is, Janet Colo?
Coco.
Coco. And do we have somebody else? Vance?
Von Edsel.
Gosh, come into committee late and you got the police in here. What's going on?
There you go. We were about to send them after you.
We got tied up in judiciary, so we figured we'd just send some bills down.
Okay, great. Thank you for being here. And whichever of you wants to go first, please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Pat Garrett. I am the chief deputy for the Washington County Sheriff's Office located in Hillsboro, Oregon. I want to express my support today for Senate Bill 707 and 708 as having oversight for hiring of some 220 enforcement deputies, about 134 jail deputies, and a half dozen civil deputies. I can say with confidence that hiring is the single most important human resources decision an appointing authority, a chief or sheriff, can make to determine the quality of service that that police law enforcement organization provides to the community and to set forth their professional reputation going forward. I have 4 points in support of Senate Bill 707 and 708. First, to varying degrees across the state of Oregon, police background investigators in their attempts to determine the suitability of police applicants are frustrated by former and current employees of those applicants who frequently provide virtually no work history information to the law enforcement agency for which they are applying out of a fear of some civil action or being liable if that work history is not stellar in some way. When you consider the axiom that past performance is an accurate predictor of future performance, the absence of credible, veracious work history prevents an appointing authority from making informed hiring decisions. Number two, these bills will require employers be very forthcoming with information about their employees who are applying to be peace officers in the state of Oregon. And the more transparency in this important part of government's role, the better when it comes to determining suitable future police officers across the state. Third and foremost, these bills will significantly improve the appointing authority's ability to make informed hiring decisions and hiring decisions in a more timely way. In my about 4 years in my current position, I can think of at least 20 occasions when we had vacancies. We had what appeared to be a suitable applicant, but we were unable to really close the loop on a credible background investigation because their current or former employers are just unwilling to provide the information that would really make us able to make a recommendation to the sheriff about to hire or not. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, for your hard work, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you. Let's hold questions till we've heard from the panel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Would you push one of those microphones a little more directed toward you? Thank you.
I'm Janet Coco, and I'm the supervisor of the Background Investigations Unit at the Washington County Sheriff's Office. I'm strongly in favor of Senate Bill 707 and 708. I think that will help me be able to perform my function at Washington County Sheriff's Office easier. In consideration of your time, my oral testimony will just supplement the written testimony I've provided. I feel the written Oregonian article regarding past school district policy to make secret deals with teachers and pass the trash was quite timely for this hearing. School administrators are now required to disclose substantiated reports of sexual misconduct rather than just pass bad teachers on to other school districts. And they've actually coined the phrase pass the trash. With these bills, we will be able to prevent passing the trash in the law enforcement community. The people of Oregon have given police officers and sheriffs, deputies, a lot of responsibility. They make life and death decisions. They are responsible for conducting investigations. They have to be impartial. They can take away people's civil liberties. They have to be able to be credible witnesses on the witness stand and testifying in court. And I think the people of Oregon understand that in order for these law enforcement officers to do this, they have to be credible, and they have to have good character. These agencies that hire law enforcement officials have to be able to have the information in order to hire officers of good character. In addition to that, currently employed officers and deputies need to know that other officers and deputies from other agencies, not just their own, are also credible and trustworthy. They may have to trust another officer with another agency with their life. They need to be able to trust officers with their own agency with their life. And they need to have confidence in these agencies that they are able to hire trustworthy and credible people to work with them. We already attempt to fulfill our obligation to the community and our risk for liability with a multi-pronged screening process that we go through to hire law enforcement officers. Oregon does not use the polygraph, and because of that, our background investigation is the foundation for our screening process to get the best possible candidates for law enforcement officers. The investigators look at the applicant's work history, we look at their education, we look at their credit reports, criminal records, driving records. We have to make a complete picture of their past and document that. The Supreme Court recently stated in a ruling that a person's past is a valid indicator of their present character, and we need to be able to create a picture of that past to know that we've got a person of high character we're looking at hiring. If we receive no information from a previous or current employers, we're missing a huge part of that individual's background picture. We must be able to determine if that person is reliable and responsible, if they're mature, if they use good judgment. And our applicants provide us with information on personal references. The personal references do provide positive information on these, and they should. They're the people that they're providing us to go talk to about them. Employers are necessary because employers will provide a more objective reference for us into how this person performs at work, how they accept responsibility, what their attendance is like. All sometimes small things, but they create a picture of a person, whether they're reliable or dependable or of good character, have a good work ethic or not. 30% of all employment applications have false information on them. We need to be able to confirm employment and confirm the character of that employment. And in lieu of not providing any information, oftentimes employers will provide references that are falsely positive in order to try to avoid liability or lawsuits. Since Senate Bill 707 outlines the type of information that employers must provide to us, including evaluations, attendance records, and any kind of discipline, that will prevent employers from giving us falsely positive references, and we should be able to get accurate information on which to assess that person. Unfortunately, many law enforcement agencies won't even share information with other law enforcement agencies, and that's a shame because I feel that we all have the same goal. We all want our officers to be of the highest caliber. We want them to be able to back each other up. We want them to be able to do the right thing. At Washington County Sheriff's Office, we've had numerous applicants found not suitable just because we've compared background information that we've received with other agencies who will share. And there is very often a pattern of an applicant applying with an agency, and the first application they disclose everything. And then as they continue to apply, they disclose less and less and less. And if we're not allowed to look at the other agency's backgrounds, we won't know what an applicant is omitting or if they're outright lying. And we could end up hiring someone based on false statements that they've made to us about their past. And another important part of Senate Bill 707, 708 is that it voids termination and severance agreements that would include confidentiality and gag orders. And as I previously stated, teachers and coaches have recently been in the news, and administrators have been accused of passing the trash because of these types of severance agreements. These severance agreements have also allowed law enforcement officers to maintain their certification and keep records confidential as long as an officer resigns quickly and quietly and gets out of the current agency they're in. But they're still allowed to apply with other agencies. And if you're the hiring agency, there's no way you can find out the truth about why they left their last agency. At the very least, a hiring agency should know the truth and be able to make a well-informed decision. And if an individual isn't qualified or isn't fit to perform the duties of a law enforcement officer at one agency, how can he be qualified and fit to perform the duties at another?
We will read your written testimony in detail, so mm-hmm. if you could just summarize, because we do have quite a few other people waiting to testify.
These bills will assist law enforcement agencies in obtaining honest and complete reference information on prospective employees in order to hire the best applicants and reduce liability. And I thank you for your consideration, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. And Representative Boquist, I see you in the back of the room. I assume you're waiting on the next bill, and you're okay, great, thank you. Okay, please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senators, my name is Dennis Griffiths.
I did. Right.
And I was one of those in the profession that has, in some part, caused some of the difficulty here. I retired from the practice of law at the end of 04. And representing a number of business clients, when they would ask me, what do I do when people ask for references? Myself and most of my colleagues all gave the same response. Give them their starting date and title. Give them their ending date and title. Don't give them anything else. And that is the easy, safe solution. And that is what a lot of businesses follow. And as Ms. Coco testified, and as Chief Deputy Garrett testified, this has resulted in a real tough job on the part of doing backgrounds. For the first couple of years after I retired, as a matter of fact, I was on-call background investigator for Hillsborough Police Department. So on one hand, I caused the problem, and then on the next hand, I was out there trying to deal with it. But these two bills are a great way to handle it. One of them requires the disclosure. The other one gives the businesses and the agencies a shield from liability. So it's a logical and fair solution, and I would ask all of you to consider passing this bill on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vaughn Etzel. I work as a detective for the City of Kaiser. I also am the sitting president for the Oregon Background Investigators Association and board member of the Oregon Peace Officers Association. And I appear before you today in support of Senate Bill 707 and 708. A lot of what I was going to say has already been addressed, but I'd like to just touch on two things briefly. One is the fragmented nature of the information that we get being engaged in background investigation since 1997, it's been my experience that the release of information runs from one extreme to the other, the one side being releasing of nothing, the other side throwing open the books and releasing everything, and everything in between that you could possibly imagine exists, including you can look at the material as long as I sit with you, and you can take notes, to you can look at the material, but you can't take notes, and it goes on from there. Having experienced that, when I took the seat of president with the Background Investigators Association, I tried to answer why, or I tried to understand why this was. And so in 2008, I sent an informal survey to the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the Oregon Chiefs of Police Association, trying to figure out what it was that prevented these agencies from releasing this information. And it really boiled down, in my view, and you have the survey in front of you, it really boiled down, in my view, in one thing, and that was liability. The 75% of the or let me back up. Only 5% of the respondents, these are all considered executive management, only 5% reported that they had been the subject or their agency had been the subject of a lawsuit. A full 95% reported having not been sued or weren't aware of being sued, yet over 75% cited lawsuits as one of the primary reasons why they did not disclose information. So if perception being reality, I don't think you'll find a better example than this, because clearly the numbers don't support their concerns. And so I just wanted, again, state that as background investigators, we are the information gatherers. We're not the decision makers. And the fragmented and very scarce information that we receive sometimes really impedes our ability to do our job as investigators and present the information to the executive management. And I thank you for your time, and I'd be available for any questions.
And I do have a question, actually. I'm not sure who wants to answer it. But going back to Senate Bill 707, it looks like under the current law, there is quite a bit of protection for employers already, in that the presumption of good faith is rebutted by a showing that the information disclosed was knowingly false or deliberately misleading or rendered with malicious purpose. That seems like a pretty high bar to meet if you're going to accuse an employer of doing one of those things. So why isn't that sufficient protection under the law for employers right now?
Madam Chair, the language that has been included in this bill will increase the level of protection. The protection that already exists is there, and I agree that it is there. However, to convince the employers, past employers, and their counsel, there's going to have to be something that appears that even greater protection has now been given to them in order to get them over the hump to where, okay, now we'll go ahead and start disclosing now because you've given us even more protection than previously. And on the other bill, where it's a requirement under the statute, that gives even greater protection. So what these are trying to do is to give a real assurance to either the agency or the private employer that they are going to be protected now when they disclose the information that may not be real positive information. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
Just a comment.
Yes.
If you don't, thank you, Madam Chair. If you were hiring, though, and an employer didn't want to send you a recommendation, wouldn't that put red flags up, and probably you would overlook that person?
Not necessarily. Excuse me, members of the committee. A lot of companies just have a blanket policy that they won't release anything good or bad. We oftentimes won't even get a response to a questionnaire that we send out. They'll send us to a pay-per-use site, like the work number or something, and that only provides information on dates of employment and their job title. And many companies, regardless of whether the information would be good or bad, they have a blanket policy to release no information on former employees.
Add to that. Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, and that's a very good point, but that works both ways, because if an agency has a blanket policy where they release no information, good candidates don't have the opportunity then to compete because their agencies won't release any information. So, thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, the reason for blanket policy is so that somebody cannot come back, a past employee cannot come back and say, well, you should have released my information, I would have gotten hired. But then the employer says, well, look, our policy is we don't release anything but starting date, ending date, titles, whether it's good or bad. That way nobody can say that, oh, well, we don't hire them because they didn't get anything, because it would have been bad information. Therefore, they use the blanket policy. And that's one of the things that these bills get around. Thank you.
Well, just to follow up, I know when I was I'm a nurse, but management in Clackamas County, and went recommendations, we were given policy, and we we did have pretty strict things that we could say, basically what you're saying, one way or another. And they would need to look for other means of convincing their new prospective employer whether they were a good person or not. I think this isn't just for law enforcement. This would actually trickle down to any employer.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, personally, I agree with you completely, and this is probably something that would need to be addressed by other professions, teachers and others, for instance. However, this one is a start where the people in law enforcement want to protect the citizens as much as they possibly can in their hiring process. And therefore, it's being addressed by this one single profession at this time. It'd be nice if a lot of other professions would address it also. Thank you.
And actually, that does raise a question that Senator Telfer and I were looking at. Senate Bill 707 doesn't appear to be restricted to law enforcement, whereas 708 is. There's something we're missing?
Madam Chair, it does appear that 707 applies to all employers. It is not as detailed and as far as the information that can be released as Senate Bill 708 is, which is specific to law enforcement. So
right.
You're testifying, it appears, on both bills, so it's a little confusing because they are different.
Right.
Madam Chair, may I say, 707 is just a modification of the original law that's already there.
Mm-hmm.
We just gave more protection to the employers for giving information. We raised the burden of proof from preponderance of evidence, which is 5149, to clear and convincing evidence, and that's pretty much the only change in that bill is we just gave the employers a little more protection and raised the burden of proof. But otherwise, it's basically the existing bill that covers all employers.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Church, did you have a question?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. There's three lines in Senate Bill 708 that concern me. The one that concerns me, if you came to me as an employer and asked for background, I suppose I could hand you over the employment file, which would have all the things that are... But in lines 25 and 26, you're asking all previous employers to sign a statement as to whether the person would be rehired by the former employer, and if the employer would not rehire the person, a statement of the reasons. Now, that seems pretty onerous on some employer. I mean, I suppose I don't mind opening my files to you to let you see what was done, but why would you make a proactive requirement on previous employers to make a statement on whether they would or wouldn't rehire somebody? I find that to be a little excessive.
That's been a pretty standard pre-employment question for background investigations, and I've worked in hiring in the past, and that's just basically a standard interview question when dealing with employee references, and it's just another way to get another feel for the individual is, would you rehire this individual or not? And sometimes other things will come up. They could have a glowing reference, they could have a great background, but they may not rehire them. You know, they may have a reason for not wanting to rehire the person. We're not asking them to make a commitment to rehire the person if they would come in and reapply. We're just asking them, theoretically, if they reapplied, would you rehire them?
Madam Chair,
do you have a follow-up?
I guess I'd say I disagree with putting that onerous back on the previous employer. In lines 14 and 15, you require that the employer disclose a salary and wage rate for the person during the person's employment. If you're hiring somebody and you're in negotiations on what the wage would be, it'd be very handy for me to know what your previous employer paid you. And I'm a little nervous. I don't understand why a future employer would need that information, because I'm in a negotiation with you, and if I was the employee, I'd just assume you not know how much I was making. And so why would that be a requirement I'd have to release to you?
Members of the committee, for law enforcement purposes, if you're an individual that You own your own home and you have no lien on it, and you own a brand new Mercedes, and the current job that you have, you earn $11 an hour. We would want to be knowing where you get your excess money from if you're independently wealthy, or by the same token, if your current employer is paying you $85,000 a year and you have judgments and liens and charge-offs and you're not paying your credit accounters, we would also want to know why your bills aren't being paid.
Madam Chair?
Yes?
A follow-up on that, though, is that, let's say, for instance, I just come from an incredibly wealthy family and I'm making $11 an hour, and I come to apply with you folks, it would make no... I find it hard to need to know what I'm making at my current job. It seems like to me that I find it a little bit if I'm in negotiations with you, if you're going to be my future employer, I'd like to negotiate with you based off of what you see. Do you see what I'm saying? Like I don't see the public purpose in that.
Yes, Senator, Madam Chair, Senator George, it goes to the entire picture that we try to build and portray as to the complete applicant. If we hire an applicant who has a credit a problem, if they were not truthful with their former wage or their current wage, and they end up being tempted as a result of their debt pattern, it goes to their credibility in a kind of a large picture. I understand your concern. It's a great question, but it is simply our ability to paint a complete applicant picture in a job that credibility ranges a huge area.
One last line.
Final question.
On page 2, lines 9 and 10, any provision of an employment termination agreement or severance agreement that conflicts with this requirement of this section is void. And I can envision a situation where an employer has an employee who perhaps was involved in a team that did something that perhaps expose the employer to liability. There's a severance agreement saying we're going to let you go with a non-disclosure of that situation. Perhaps it was a sexual harassment situation or some things like that. And that's a termination agreement between the employer and the employee. You sever that, and I'm a little concerned about that particular at least the way I read it, it severs that, and I'm a little concerned about the liability then put on top of the previous employer by having that particular confidentiality agreement severed. Am I reading that incorrectly?
Madam Chair, Senator George, by making a statutory requirement that it be disclosed, the employer, past employer, is then having to comply with the current law and having to disclose it. It is no longer something where they are giving up something that was a matter of choice for them. And their compliance with this statute is then required. Your earlier comment on page, the first page, I believe that there's an Amendment 1 to this bill that may have taken care of that section.
Okay.
Okay. Did you have a question?
Question in regard to that is, don't we have state statute that does not allow a law to go back and restrict an existing contract? I mean, I'm not sure this one would be enforceable, page 2, line 8. I don't have a problem with it. I'm just wondering if it's, in fact, enforceable.
Madam Chair, I just don't have the answer to that one.
We might be able to get an answer to that question from legislative too. Okay, I think, did you have an additional question?
Or? I've got a couple of comments.
Okay, can I present?
I'm just looking at Senator Telfer, what the section that you were talking about was?
She was referring to, on page 2 of 708,
subsection 6, any provision of an employment termination agreement or severance agreement that conflicts with the requirements of this section is void.
Lines 9 and 10.
Right. 9s and 10, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems somewhat suspect as to what you can undercut with whatever the contract may be. I guess I want to kind of go over, first of all, I want to say I support the concepts here. I am surprised to hear that 30% of the information that's on not every employment application turns out to be false. That just shocks me that we have that type of, let's say, inaccurate or untruthful information that's coming out. But I am going to put on the record that in judiciary we have looked at some different bills where we're trying to limit the exposure to governmental units and authorities, and I believe there may be a constitutional issue here. So I've just passed something to the chair, and we're going to ask legal counsel and our administrator to look at it to see what we can or can't do in the sense the type of protections that can be given. And the other part I have a question about is whether or not we can't just require the disclosure to be made instead of saying that they only give name, rank, and serial number. Because it sounds like the chair said under 707, the existing law already gives a protection, and why we would need to raise it to the highest standard in the civil burden of proof of clear and convincing versus this preponderance. I think that's going to be an issue that we'll have to work through. But I will say again, I am very supportive because I know from my job as a prosecutor, the last thing you want to do is have an officer that's in any field, but specifically in areas where they have such power to actually turn out to be someone that was known to the previous employer to not be forthright, being able to do their job, and you just pass that on to another community.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. We have two other witnesses signed up to testify, and I'll call them now, Michael Dale and Sybil Hebb. Good afternoon, and please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Dale. I'm the Executive Director of the Northwest Workers Justice Project. The Northwest Workers Justice Project represents low-wage contingent workers. Now, contingent workers are those workers that are trying to be engaged full-time in the economy but are, for one reason or another, very precariously attached to a job or job situations. They may be working for a temp agency. They may be working for a contractor. They may be treated as a contractor when, in fact, they're an employee, those kinds of workers. I can tell you, as an attorney representing those kinds of workers, that one of the biggest problems with compliance with our wage and hour statutes, our discrimination statutes, our statutes about sexual harassment, our statutes about safety in the workplace, one of the biggest obstacles is the fear of the employee, first, that they will lose their job, but worse than that, that in losing their job, they won't have a reference, and that in fact that they will be blacklisted and be retaliated against for having raised the issue to begin with. Now, that's against the law. It's against current law to blacklist. We have a statute that says you can't blacklist, but there's no remedy under that statute. I can tell you that under the existing standard, those are some of the most difficult cases to prove on behalf of representing an employer. An employee would have to show, first of all, that a statement was made from one employer to another. That's difficult to do frequently. If you can show the statement was made, you then have to show that the statement was false. That may or may not be difficult. Oftentimes, you can kill someone's application by nuance and by a question, by a shrug, and it may not be exactly the words that you speak that are false. It's the implication that's false, and that's very difficult to prove. Then beyond that, under existing law, one would have to prove not only that the statement was false, but as a practical matter, you would have to prove that the employer knew that it was false or recklessly disregarded its falsity or truthfulness. that's extraordinarily difficult because you're reaching into someone's mind and trying to say what they knew at that particular point in time, what their intent was, were they acting in good faith or bad faith. The net result is these cases are not easy cases at all, and it was interesting to me the testimony earlier in the last panel about the likelihood of suit. In the reality of the situation, not very many of these cases are brought. That doesn't surprise me at all because they are so difficult to bring. It isn't that people are not discriminated against or retaliated against or blacklisted. It is that it is so difficult to prove the case and to prove the damages flowing from the case. Now, what the testimony is also earlier is that in spite of the fact that almost no one gets sued and there seems to be ample protection in the law against suit, employers currently believe apparently that they might get sued and so they're not sharing information. Well, is there anything that says that if you raise the burden of proof, they're any more likely to disclose information, or are they still going to take the safe and easy route of not disclosing anything at all and not taking any risk? Are they even going to know you changed the statute? It seems to me that what you're doing here, what this bill would do, is provide essentially a license to blacklist, a license to defame, with virtually no possibility of any accountability. And we're very supportive of the idea that police officers ought to be well-qualified and ought to be the right kind of people in those kinds of positions. That's an important societal interest. But as has been noted earlier, Senate Bill 707 is not limited to persons who are applying for public safety officer positions. This applies to every job. It applies to 7-Eleven. It applies to a farm worker trying to get hired. It applies to everything, and it would be extremely ill-advised, and we would strongly recommend against adoption of Senate Bill 707. We take no position with respect to 708, other than the general position that we think it's a good idea that police officers be well qualified.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here to voice opposition to Senate Bill 707. I don't have a position on 708, but would just echo that from the Law Center's perspective, we, as you know, provide civil legal services to low-income people across Oregon. We all know that in these times of economic struggle, it's a hurdle to find employment for everybody, and that hurdle is greater and more important in many circumstances to low-income Oregonians who may often be a single paycheck away from being able to make a rent payment or getting food on the table for their families. And so we're very concerned about barriers to employment for people, and we believe that Senate Bill 707 would be a barrier to employment because it would make it easier for inappropriate retaliation against employees. We recognize and understand that references are an important criteria that people take into account when they're making hiring decisions, and that's very appropriate. A bad reference can ensure a job denial, and unfortunately sometimes we see cases in which an employee may have, for example, filed an OSHA complaint because of a workplace safety issue, or may have, through no action of their own, been called to be a witness, for example, in another employee's case. And there are times when employers are disgruntled about that and may choose to retaliate against an employee because of that behavior. In that circumstance, we want to make sure that Oregon's public policy takes a stance against that, and it does under the current law, but we want to make sure that the barrier to an employee's asserting that claim is not so great that they could never overcome the barrier. And we agree that from, I think, current comments have been made that the current law is very protective already of employers, and the presumption is that the employer is acting in good faith, and there is a barrier. The burden is on the employee raising a claim claim to overcome that burden, and it has to do so in a very specific way. There's already a greater burden on the employee than exists in many other employment law statutes, because not only is the presumption in favor of the employer, there are also specific criteria that have to be met in order for the employee to overcome that presumption. So raising the standard, the level of proof to clear and convincing evidence, we believe would be too great a barrier and would be contrary to public policy. So that's the perspective from which we share our concerns, and we really appreciate your attention to the issue.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for these witnesses? Okay.
Thank you.
You very much.
Madam Chair, yes. Do you have anyone else that's going to be
testifying? I did not.
Can I just put something else back on the record?
Yes, go ahead.
This is going back to what Senator Telfer asked. Looking on page 1 of that 708, starting on line 27, it has a sub 3, and it talks about the limitations what the employer can actually provide that is prohibited by state law and federal law. And then when I read that sub 6 that she brought a question of, I believe that would be basically we may be setting a state policy for future contracts that may be entered into, in the sense that if anyone tries to use an employment termination agreement or severance agreement after the date of this being in effect, it would be deemed to be void, and that would be able to be exposed as compared to something that happened in prior time.
Isn't it great to have an attorney on the...
Well, it is indeed.
You get what you pay for, so you never know what that is.
Okay, and with nobody else signed up to testify, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 707 and Senate Bill 708 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 872. Jeremy.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 872... requires a contracting agency to give preference to Oregon resident bidders in public contracts in circumstances where tax revenues from resident bidder would exceed the preference amount. Increases bids of non-resident bidders by 5% or by a percentage equal to any preference given by the non-resident bidder's state of residence. We have a statement of no revenue impact, which we just received prior to coming to the meeting, and we have no fiscal on this bill.
We don't have a fiscal?
No.
Okay. So I see Senator Brian Boquist, if you'd like to come forward, and Friends. Okay. And Senator Boquist, I apologize. I apparently called you representative. You and I were both representatives at the same time, so... seem to have been regressing.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not sure whether we're regressing or not. For the record, I am Brian Boquist, State Senator from District 12, which includes portions of 5 rural counties of Oregon here in the Western Valley, and including the megalopolis of McMinnville and the city of Dallas. I'm joined today here by Joe Munger, who is, I'm proud to say, one of my constituents and hardworking union members from the United Steelworkers Local 8378 out in McMinnville. And in discussions early in the session, you recall, Madam Chair, in the first couple of weeks, the legislature passed out a stimulus bill to try and put people in Oregon back to work. During that same discussion, Joe and others came to my office, and we started talking about strengthening Oregon's, basically Oregon's Buy Oregon First policy. We, like 34 other states in the nation, have a preference policy. I asked the co-chairs, of course, to add that into any of the spending bills they sent out so that we remember that we should think first in Oregon when we go to purchase. This is extraordinary times. The piece of paper that I had passed out to you, I got from the Employment Department in the last couple of days, and I will call to you. It is the labor market information. Lower right-hand column shows the U6 unemployment rate at 24.3% on average in the state of Oregon. That's a huge number. To the bill, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the intent of this bill was just to ensure that we consider purchasing and buying products and hiring companies in Oregon first, as long as it fits with the Interstate Commerce Clause and the Marketing Clause across the country. As I mentioned, 34 states have preferences. Our neighboring states have preferences, and you heard the good committee administrator say that if a preference across the border in Washington, if we give a preference in a contract, contractor from Washington comes and submits a bid, we must give them the equal amount of preference. The reason there's a 5% number in there is there was much discussion between legal counsel and what has been acceptable across the various states, 34 that have them, and discussions with Legislative Revenue Office in what tax revenues do we forego when out-of-state companies come in and do what I call TUI, temporary work. As you well know, in many cases, out-of-state companies can come in, do short-term work, and leave the state, and they don't pay income taxes. They don't pay employment taxes. They don't pay unemployment taxes. And many of the workers don't pay income taxes for that temporary work that's done here in the state of Oregon. And that is a loss to the revenue stream to the state of Oregon. That's why we came up with a 5% clause that's in there. And that's why you'll see on lines 24 and 25 where we talk about in there the calculation. And there's a formula LRO can utilize that simply identifies what's the tax loss up to that 5%. Having said that, Madam Chair, again, my intent is simply to buy Oregon First, and we do a good job of it right now in the agencies in which we track it. I'm sure Department of Administrative Services will be here, and they track some agencies, and we have some areas where 79% of all the goods and services we buy are bought here in Oregon, we believe. However, we don't track and we don't know what we do in the Oregon University system, which is a huge chunk of change. When you add in K-12 and Education Department, we don't know what we do in K-12. Likewise, we don't know what we do in the Department of Transportation. Now, for those on Ways and Means, when you add those lumps together, that's a huge chunk of money that does a lot of contracting out there that would put a lot of prevailing wage workers in the state of Oregon back to work. So what we're simply asking is that we consider strengthening the Buy Oregon policy, and I again will ask the co-chairs later on to insert the existing one into the budget bills that we have, reminding our good agencies and our good agency directors that we should buy Oregon First. And with that, I'm going to, if you would, Madam Chair, introduce Joe Munger, who is from the Steelworkers local in McMinnville, who is a big proponent of this, and it was his idea to go forward with this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, for the record, my name is Joe Munger, United Steelworkers, Local 8378 in McMinnville, Oregon. I work at Cascade Steel. Cascade Steel has a parent company, Schnitzer, which it buys its scrap from in Portland, Oregon. Also, that scrap is sold to Schnitzer by Oregon companies. We create a product, mainly reinforcing bar, and that product is sold to Far West Steel in Eugene, and Eugene also sells that product to construction outfits and stuff that work in Oregon, so you can see the impact of the product that we make in Oregon. That was kind of the idea. We have some projects, big bridge products in Portland coming up, and it would be a shame if Cascade Steel's reinforcing bar wasn't in the bridges. There's steel that's provided in Nucor from Utah and Washington, and also in Southern California. So there's four steel mills left on the West Coast. The senator kind of took all my stuff, but
Madam Chair, for the record, it was independent.
So I'm looking through to try to see if there's anything I can offer, but he kind of hit everything. So with that, if you have any questions.
Any questions?
One question.
Yes, Senator Pruszynski.
Yeah, Senator Boquist, I vaguely remember the governor at one point making some type of executive order as to us doing stuff more locally.
Yeah.
Do you know whether or not there was something in there? Because I'm wondering, as you are, as to whether or not his order went out for the higher ed as well as K-12 as to how their purchasing should be done for having a preference for buying Oregon.
Madam Chair, Senator Pruszynski, I don't know the distance it went out. It was issued under the existing preference laws, and I cannot tell you if that Buy Oregon portion actually reached the purchasing officers at the Department of Transportation, the purchasing officers at the Department of Education, and so on. And I think that's the key issue here, Madam Chair, Senator Pruszynski, is the communication isn't flowing well, and I think most people are well-intentioned, and our goal here is to strengthen and communicate so we can put our workers back to work.
Okay. Yes, Senator Munis-Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that when we had our Oregon stimulus package that went out, and I was had the privilege this weekend to visit Mount Hood Community College, where we got $3.2 million. And we got on the roof with about 20 men, and the president said that it was by Oregon. That they were given the directive to make sure that they hired locally. And so I know it's happening with the Oregon stimulus money that we have out there, and it is actually working with our community college. And that's why I keep thinking that if there's something more with our, but at least with the community college mine, they actually did hire locally. And it was interesting, one man who was laid off from our mortgage company was actually working on the roof as a roofer, doing the work.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Munis-Anderson, I think you're absolutely correct in the community college arena. Community colleges have a direct connection with local boards, and of course local boards and community colleges, their primary function, as you know, is to stimulate economic development through job training in their local communities. And so there's a direct connection, I think, in all the boards and most of the charters that say they buy locally. I'm not as confident as you are in some of the other projects, but I wish I were.
Okay, thank you both for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We have one more witness, and that is Mike Sullivan. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I'm the political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers in Oregon. And pulp and paper workers are facing the same issues as steel workers in the sense that we're an endangered species, two-legged, I might add. We don't fly or we don't swim. And any consideration that would help industrial workers, of course, AWPPW would support, and we do. To us, it's physically responsible to do, and I mean that with the F, not the P, to enhance the ability of businesses in Oregon to work. Yeah, or workers to work and businesses to survive. And really, that's about all I have to say. I have a lighter note to bring forth. Joe didn't force me to come here. I happen to be the past president of the local he represents now. And currently, Joe's the president of the Labor Council here in Salem, Polk, Marion, and Yamhill County, and I'm the past president, so we do kind of fly on the same path, if you will. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. That completes our sign-up list. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on Senate Bill 872? Seeing no one, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 872. We have one bill remaining, and it is House Bill 2203, and I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2203.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2203A, comes from the Employment Department and deals with unemployment insurance. It establishes that the original bill establishes that in a case of conflict between a provision of Oregon Employment Department law and another provision of state law, Employment Department law prevails. It clarifies that the types of employment that will end in individuals' disqualification from unemployment insurance benefits are limited to employment subject to Oregon Employment Department law or equivalent law in another state or Canada, employment required to be covered under the Federal Unemployment Tax Act, or employment by the federal government. We have a statement of no revenue impact and on the initial bill, no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. Subsequently, the department has given us what is now the -3 proposed amendments, and I'll let them describe the nature of those amendments, but basically, generally speaking, those amendments cover four different subjects which are important to the department in order to comply with federal guidelines, and once again, as we have before, where compliance with federal guidelines is important in keeping Oregon Employment Department qualified to get funds from the federal government.
Okay, and I think people are confused because they see a -82.
I don't see a 3.
Yeah, I do have 3.
dash A3.
There was a dash A2. That has been subsequently replaced with the dash A3, which I think you should all have a copy of.
A3?
It
looks like they do.
Nope, no.
A2.
A2. So are we the only ones that have the A3s? Does anyone have them down there?
Nope.
No one has them.
We're on the team.
Okay. I have one extra copy with me. The A3 has only one very small change from the A2, and it has to do, I think, with backdating that the department can describe. So fundamentally, the A2, the dash A2 amendment is...
copies are on the way.
Okay, good.
I have one, so...
I think it's just us two and the other two. Perfect. Thank you.
Chair? Yes, Senator Telfer.
Could I ask, since it's a fairly lengthy dash,
uh-huh.
You said there was only one minor change, having read this
No, there's only one minor change from the A2 to the A3. Right.
Exactly. Could you tell us what that minor change versus reading these
And we also
21
have,
pages?
And we have the Employment Department here to tell us about it, too, so I'm sure they can do that.
I believe I could, but if the department's here, I'll let them do it to make sure that it's...
Tom's pretty good at that.
Yeah, right. Why don't we call Tom Byerly?
He's ready to come.
Please come forward. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Byerly, Administrator for the Employment Department, Unemployment Trust Division. Real quickly, I'll go to the amendment for the dash threes over the dash twos. And Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, if you would, members of the committee, if you would turn to page 20, section 10.
Of the threes?
Of the dash threes, thank you. If you go to the bottom of the page in paragraph two, what it used to be.
Line number.
Oh, I'm sorry. Good catch. Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, line 28 is where the dash 3 amendment begins. It used to read in the dash 2s, beginning on or after the effective date of the act. It now reads beginning on or after February 22, 2009. That's the only change. I'll just jump right onto that amendment right now. With the passage of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act that was signed by the President on February 17th. The federal government is allowing us to pay extended benefits, which is a federal-state shared extension. Now the federal government is covering all the costs of that extension, so it would not come out of the state trust fund at all. They're allowing us to go back to the date of enactment and pay extended benefits to claimants who had otherwise lost or exhausted their benefits and we couldn't reach under current state law. So we're putting that in there to go back retroactively to that date in February so we could catch some claimants up that may still be out of work and without unemployment insurance benefits. So I know that's kind of taking the amendments out of order, but that was what the dash three. That's the only change from the dash two to the dash threes.
Virtually the same.
Mm-hmm. Other than that, they're identical.
Okay. Great. Anything else?
No.
Okay, and this looks like an extremely important bill in order to make sure that we have the lot lined up and that we can access these benefits. So.
Yes, Madam Chair, would you like me to go over the bill? Or
yeah, that would be great.
Is that sure. Okay? Okay. The committee administrator accurately described what House Bill 2203A originally did. And subsequent to passage in the House of that bill, we learned with the passage of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act that there was some technical corrections to Oregon law we would need to make to qualify for the Unemployment Insurance Modernization Stimulus Payments. You'll recall that my director, Lori Warner, and I came to this committee to talk about Senate Bill 462 and the alternate base period and how that qualified us for the first third of the potential $85 million that Oregon could get for the trust fund under the Reinvestment Act. As the the law at the federal level was being contemplated, we were pretty sure in Oregon that we had all the provisions already in law to qualify us for the second two-thirds had we gotten through the alternate base period. Well, as they say, the devil's in the detail, and once the law was signed and House Resolution 1 was gone over by the U.S. Department of Labor, we learned that we did indeed need to make some technical corrections to our law. And so we used this bill, because of the relating to costs, to put those amendments in so we can qualify for the second or the other two-thirds of that $85 million, or it's approximately $57 million additional dollars that we could stick into the trust fund. What the Dash 2s do is it makes, again, technical corrections to current law, and we would change the domestic violence criteria in the law. We've had that in the statute for quite a while, that if an individual or their family member, more specifically their child, is subject to domestic violence, they could leave that job to get away from the situation. The federal law wanted us to change the way we describe that a little bit, and so those changes are on page 7 of the Dash 3 amendments, beginning in line 16 in the bolded language. You can see those changes there. And this is language that we actually ran by the U.S. Department of Labor in Washington to make sure we got this language correct to qualify for these funds. I've made sure they were aware that I'm going to get one shot before the legislature to make this change. We want to do it right the first time. The second correction would be with the extended benefit programs we offer to workers in training. And there was a line in the bill, in the current law, that said you can get extended benefits while you're in training, subject to availability of funds. And that section has been in there for a long, long time. I think back to 91 when we first started that with a timber worker shortage. And our trust fund, as you all know, has always been healthy. So the subject to availability funds, really we never bumped into that. Unfortunately, the U.S. Department of Labor says, well, there's a clause there that may be a limiting factor, so they want us to take that out. So we did that. I think that's on page 19, starting from line 24 in the Dash 3s, so you see the subject availability of funds being deleted. Mm-hmm. And again, that was at the recommendation of the U.S. Department of Labor. The third really important part of this is, again, as I said, with the Dash 3s, is we are able to reach back to claimants and pay extended benefits. It's normally a federal-state shared 50-50 extension. We can go back to claims that expired. Normally, we can't pay extended benefits outside of their benefit year. When a claimant files a claim, it's good for 52 weeks. In tough economic times, claimants sometimes are unemployed longer than a year, and we were not able to pay outside this particular extension outside of their benefit year. The emergency unemployment compensation extension, however, we could pay outside of their benefit year. Because of the way that the dates came or qualified these claimants, there are some that don't qualify for the extended benefits, and this would allow us to go back. And within these Dash 3s, it'll open it up for a period of a year, and then when the federal funding of this ends December 31 of this year, the law reverts back to the way it was. In other words, we won't pay outside the benefit year, and it'll go back to a 50-50 shared cost on the extension. So this is just a narrow period of time where we can take advantage of some additional federal monies, and we're estimating that we could receive as much as $53 million that we could pay out in extended benefits to unemployed Oregonians. So that, in a nutshell, we have, you know, three pretty major things we're covering with this bill, and it will, once this is all covered, it, in addition to the $53 million in benefits we could pay in extension, we would then get the other $58 million $57 million, excuse me, that we put right into the trust fund to help mitigate tax increases.
Well, that's
happy to answer any questions.
Great news. So, any questions about that? I don't see any. And just to clarify, so the Dash A3 amendment is now the only amendment we need?
That's true.
Okay. Because it contains everything that was in the other.
Yes, Madam Chair. We thought the Dash A2s had it all, and then we realized that under the federal law, we could go back to February 22nd, so we wanted to make sure we got that.
Right. Great.
And okay. The federal government will cover those costs.
Okay. Thank you very much for...
Thank you very much for your time.
...your testimony. And, members, we won't be able to move this bill today because we don't have the fiscal on the amendment, but we can adopt the amendment. And so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2203 and open a work session on House Bill 2203. And Senator Manis Anderson?
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 3A3s into Senate Bill, or House Bill 2203.
Senator Manis Anderson moves the Dash A3 amendment to House Bill 2203. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Is there any? No. Any objection? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Okay, and that's as far as we can go,
Madam Chair.
Today. So, before you do that, though, I just because actually, we don't have the same limitation on this bill, but we might as well carry it over to our next hearing anyway. So, why don't we carry this work session over to our next hearing?
We could suspend the rules if everyone agrees.
But Senator George brought up that issue, and I did not hear back, as a chair, whether we got that final approval. But Senator George, why don't you say what happened to your committee?
I think it's a case-by-case basis that basically they're going to leave it up to members of the committee to sort of make the determination. So I don't know if we need Senator Telfer here.
Do we have to have unanimous consent, or
we do need unanimous consent? I think in this case, though, because this is a House bill, we're not under a huge time crunch.
Right.
I mean, we do have some time to get this done.
In fact, I think the limitation was for bills from our chamber going that way.
Right, I think that's right. So, okay.
And I think there is some time pressure on this bill because they have to get it back through the House and then have it completed have it signed.
That's true.
Move this as expeditiously as possible.
Madam Chair, did we get a date as to when it needs to move
now
by?
Now we can have unanimous consent.
Tom, did you want to give us that information?
Madam Chair, if I may, the time crunch will be the passage of the extended benefits provision will allow us to go ahead and reach back to these claimants that are actually out of benefits right now. That's the real time crunch. Once the bill is passed and the governor signs it, we will be sending an application to the federal government for these funds, and they have to respond to us within 30 days. The extended benefits part, however, would be effective upon passage and signing by the governor. We don't have to apply for those. We just have to show that the law has been passed.
Mm-hmm.
So. No specific time crunch, just we'd like to reach out to those unemployed workers if we could.
If you have it by Monday.
Hopefully
would
we will.
Days make a difference?
Madam Chair, Senator Monahan, Mr. Anderson, days would not make a difference. So, we're still working on the programming. We're doing our best to get ready. So.
We just carried this over to our next hearing, which
Monday.
Would be Monday.
Okay.
So I think hopefully we'll get the fiscal back by
good.
Monday.
Thank you very much.
The only thing we did while you were out of the room was to adopt the amendment into the bill, which we did without objection. So I'll close the work session on House Bill 2203. That completes our agenda. Members, we're adjourned. Thank you.